Hi, and welcome to another edition of The Brand Called You. This is a video cast and a podcast in which I talk to some of the most fascinating thought leaders from around the world. And today is absolutely no exception. I'm super excited to welcome Dr. Bruce Chilton to the program. Welcome, Dr. Chilton. Bruce Chilton is a scholar of one of my most fascinating periods of history, which is early Christianity and Judaism, that period where Judaism was morphing into Christianity. And he's written a plethora of books, including The Rabbi Jesus, The Rabbi Paul, Mary Magdalene, a biography. He wrote a book called Abraham's Curse about the roots of violence in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And one of his latest books, which is, in my estimation, one of the most fascinating, called The Herods, Murder, Politics, and the Art of Secession, about this dynastic family that actually makes the Sopranos look like Mother Teresa. So welcome, Dr. Chilton. Now, I want to start by of course, sharing a story with you, which is that, you know, you've heard that Jesus saves people, but what you may not know is you saved me. And I don't mean that to turn you into a deity, but actually what happened was about 20 years ago, I was living in a one-room little studio apartment on 10th Avenue. I had to pay extra for the cockroaches and the garbage trucks. And I just needed to get out of town, and I spontaneously went up to the Catskills one day and, in an ultimate act of spontaneity and stupidity, bought a house then and there. It was beautiful and cheap. And I actually, the mortgage was cheaper than the price of a parking garage in New York. And I thought I could do this, you know. And I suddenly found myself, a Jewish girl who'd never changed a light bulb in a house in the country in Sullivan County, the cultural desert of the US with nothing to do and nowhere to go. And I was so lonely. And I saw an ad for this wonderful lunchtime lecture series that you were running up at Bard College. And I think at the time it was on the prophets. And of course, I'm a little bit of an amateur theologian. And so I dutifully jumped in my car and drove about 45 minutes up a sinusoidal hill over the mountain. And I was hooked. And you might not know this, but I actually met a Lutheran minister in a hardware store, and I threw him in my car too. And we became fans. So you really did save me in a way, so thank you for that.
Many thanks, Lisa. It's good to see you again, if virtually.
Well, or if we'll call it spiritually for the purposes of this talk. But, you know, I've always been super, super fascinated by who Jesus was as a guy. And it might have been prompted by the fact that when I was about 28, I dated a groovy Reconstructionist rabbi who wore one of those tie-dyed shmatas, the flowing shmatas, and he had this guitar. And I thought to and he used to love to bless people. I mean, it was kind of embarrassing. Like, he'd be like, let me bless you. I'm like, stop. He's my accountant, don't bless him. But anyway, what was interesting was I thought to myself, I wonder if that's what Jesus would have maybe perhaps been if he'd remained Jewish today. Who was Jesus?
Well, I think that he is best defined as being a prophetic figure within Galilean Judaism. And that puts him inside a particular political setting. And one of the purposes of the book, The Herods, is to permit us to see that setting in particular. Who was the ruler of the area? This person whose actual name was Antipas. And why was it that Antipas turned against, first of all, Jesus' own teacher, John the Baptist, and actually had John the Baptist executed by beheading? And then why did he try to kill Jesus, which he also attempted? So one of the purposes of the analysis is to put Jesus in his actual political setting. You know, very often, when we think of politics within this period, we turn to the Roman Empire, a vitally important influence. But inside the Roman Empire, you have microclimates of politics. And Herod Antipas was one of the most important of those. And then, of course, when Jesus left the domain of Herod Antipas and went to Jerusalem, he found himself now under the influence of the direct appointee of Rome, namely Pontius Pilate. And so then his actual death is a result of an alliance between Herod Antipas and Pontius Pilate. It's an amazing story, and those events could only have unfolded during that particular period of the Roman Empire, because the local politics of Rome were also involved. You know, Tip O'Neill was right. All politics is local. And the fact that they're local doesn't make them any less vicious than they truly are.
It wasn't. Now, again, I realize when we talk about the Herods, we're talking about multi-generations. And as you rightly point out, a father is not a son, is not a brother. But wasn't Herod of that period Jewish?
Yes. There's no question about that, whatever. By the time the entire family came to power, and this is near the time of the birth of Herod the Great, Herod himself, Herod the Great, was born around the year 74. Before the Common Era. By that time, their region, which was called Edom or Idumea, had all been converted to Judaism. And in fact, the Herodian family started their political lives as being loyal servants of the Maccabean rulers of Israel. Now, this background as an Edomian caused those who were opposed to Herod the Great to refer to him as being a half-Jew. But that was by no means accurate, is just what you happen to say.
Weren't the Maccabeans the most fervent of the Jews?
Absolutely, they came to power as a result of their fervent opposition to an attempt to Hellenize the city of Jerusalem and even worship in the temple. They were the most effective Jewish resistance organization until the modern period, and they came to power on that basis. By the time that the Herods came to have influence, however, Rome had made itself felt in the area, and the Maccabees themselves had fallen to interdynastic squabbles. So the result of that was that the very person that they had used in order to tame Edom or Idumea was able to offer his services to the Romans to be an intermediary between that military occupation and the Maccabean regime. Over time, Herod the Great was able to use his influence in Rome to be named actually as king of Judea. Now, that was not in any sense a religious appointment. That happened in the Senate in Rome. He was actually presented by Mark Antony and Octavius as being Rome's best chance of keeping their enemies at bay in the Near East. His success was entirely on the basis of his military acumen, and that was considerable. Herod the Great was one of the great horsemen of his time. He actually, until shortly before his death, would spend hours on horseback for the fun of it. When he wasn't in battle, he was hunting. I mean, for him, this was a completely natural way of life.
A Jew on a horse?
Isn't it amazing? He breaks so many stereotypes. And similarly, he breaks the stereotype that in order to be loyal to Judaism, you have to oppose the Gentiles. He got along with the Romans extremely well. He was able to use their support actually for the benefit of Judaism. You know, we all visit in Jerusalem today the remains of the Second Temple. Right. And we marvel at that magnificent wall that enclosed the sanctuary proper. That was built by Herod the Great. It was he who made it one of the most magnificent sites in the ancient world.
You're talking about the Second Temple.
The Second Temple, exactly.
which leads me to maybe my next question, which is a lot of Jews, myself included, believe that the continuity of Judaism was only made possible by the destruction of that very temple. And I wonder if the same could be said for Christianity, and if you even believe that line at all.
Well, I think that the destruction of the temple in its time was a disaster, both for Judaism and for what came to be called Christianity. It was a disaster for Judaism because the temple was the only thing about which there was a consensus. That is, there was agreement that the temple in Jerusalem was where the God of Israel was to be worshiped by sacrifice. As a matter of fact, even the Romans participated in this belief, because the Roman emperor had on his behalf sacrificed every day, twice a day, animals for his welfare.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I'm trying to get this picture. So right before the destruction, is it a bit of a, as in Hebrew, they call it a baligan, where you have religious Jews doing sacrifice to the letter of the law, and then you have some Romans slipping in doing something that's totally unkosher
It's all actually run by the priesthood.
Okay.
And according to the understanding of certainly the written Torah, in the case of the Sadducees, and then in the case of the Pharisees, they also have an extra layer of oral tradition regarding purity. So although the personnel that actually offers the sacrifice is Jewish and priestly, that doesn't mean they're not arguing. At this period, there's even a deep controversy over the question, what exact calendar do we follow to determine when Yom Kippur is, when Shavuot is, when Sukkot is, when Pesach is?
The bickering is as old as the Torah as itself, right?
Exactly. As soon as you have an authoritative tradition that we agree we have to follow, we then immediately will argue over what it properly means and how we should go about interpreting that. So the Romans had, to an extent, accepted the validity of the temple, because the Romans gave Judaism a provision which was remarkable within the empire. If you were a practitioner of Judaism, you could not be required to offer sacrifice to the emperor's image. Others in the empire could.
Really?
That is, if I were a Roman magistrate, I would simply expect wealthy landowners in my particular region willingly to offer their wealth and to sponsor games in the emperor's behalf, and as part of that, to set up an image of the emperor and to burn incense to it, to pour out some wine in front of it, and then to swear allegiance to what was called the genius of the emperor.
So he was seen as a semi-deity, so to speak.
On the way to being a deity, and some of the emperors who were unbalanced actually thought of themselves being deities. I think we have many examples in our time of ideologies of this kind taking over without the benefit of the imperial cult. And this happened to some emperors. So in the case of Judaism, you could not require that.
Wow. Is it because they needed the tax money, or they were genuinely afraid of Hashem on high?
It was not that. It was rather that when the Romans first had contact with Judea, it was during the time of the Maccabees. Rome was still a republic. It was not yet a major military power in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. And as a result, they actually went into an alliance with the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. And in that alliance, there was a pact of mutual defense in the case of attack. But when you make an alliance, you recognize the gods of the other partner by definition. Oh. And so the Romans had to accept that within Judaism, there could not be what is in Judaism, idolatry.
Okay.
from the Roman point of view, it's not idolatry. It's just, for them, it was common sense. Mm-hmm. But they accepted that Judaism would not do this. And so they made this remarkable arrangement in which, instead of worshiping the emperor, you prayed for the emperor, because the emperor arranged to have a sacrifice on his behalf offered by the priesthood in Jerusalem.
Clever.
Wonderfully clever. And therefore, you can see what would happen in the year 66 when a faction of priestly nationalists decided, we're not doing that anymore.
It's like turning off the Shabbat elevator in the hospital.
Exactly. And that was when the Senate decided to dispatch Vespasian, the Roman general, with his mammoth armies. And that's what unleashed the true terror of the Jewish war, which effectively concluded in the year 70 when the temple was destroyed. Although there were holdouts, famously, at Masada for a considerable period after.
And you talk initially at it being a tragedy, but then later on, didn't it sort of force us to internalize our Torah and our Judaism and sustain it in more creative ways, perhaps? Or
I think that's exactly the case. And this, in a way, was the irony of the Roman intervention. Something to bear in mind is that the Romans intervened famously from 66 to 70, destroying the temple. They did it again in the year 132 to 135.
Right.
And on that occasion, in fact, they renamed Jerusalem and gave it the name of Jupiter's territory. The Romans were ruthless because they had ultimately come to the conclusion that from this part of the world, they were getting only problems. And that therefore they would intervene and put an end to it. Well, instead of that, they wound up with two problems. Instead of that, they wound up with both Judaism and Christianity, the latter of which, of course, brought them down ultimately. And the reason for this emergence has a great deal to do with the destruction of the temple. As you say, from the point of view of Judaism, the fact of the disappearance of the temple meant that there needed to be a compensation. Mm-hmm. And that compensation was an extraordinary renewed emphasis upon the Torah as an interior possession of both the community and any human being who wanted to turn to the Torah. Of course, the Torah had been important before. I'm not denying that. But for example, think of all the different laws there are related to sacrifice.
Yeah.
You can't do them anymore. Mm-mm. Impossible. And yet the conception emerged that the study of those very rules is itself a form of sacrifice, which one is then internalizing. This is occurring at the same time, of course, because of the destruction of the temple, when the priests have lost their power base. But the group known as the Pharisees, over the course of time, coalesced with sages whom we call the rabbis, mm-hmm. with their understanding that a deep understanding of the Torah, both as written and also as oral, is actually what makes Israel Israel. Now, in the same period, Christianity also is facing a disaster because the leadership of the early Christian movement had largely been in Jerusalem and indeed had been centered on the temple.
Isn't it true that to be in the Jesus movement, initially you had to convert to Judaism?
Well, initially speaking, all of the followers of Jesus, of course, were Galilean Jews, and then ultimately Judean Jews, Jews of various descriptions. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons for the tension in regard to what became called Christianity. The conception emerged that it would actually be possible for Gentiles to be immersed and to receive God's Spirit, to join this movement, therefore, without converting to Judaism. Mm-hmm. There was an enormous controversy about mm-hmm. this within the church itself, because there were those who rightly said, yes, of course, anyone is welcome to accept this immersion in Jesus' name and the reception of spirit. But then while doing that, you also have to undertake the covenant of circumcision, because after all, the book of Genesis says that. That is the example of Abraham. And there was an important part of the early Christian movement which insisted upon that. And that part of the movement survived the period of the New Testament. And in fact, a group of Christians who continued to practice circumcision, and with that also to accept the halakhot of Judaism, continued to exist until the Muslim period. However, the side of Christianity we hear about from the New Testament did not go in that direction. Instead, led by a figure whose name was James, the brother of Jesus, they maintained that you could be baptized, receive the Spirit. You did not have to accept circumcision, but they insisted you should not eat food which had been sacrificed to idols. You should not consume blood. And also you should not engage in marriages which were with relations who were too close. In other words, you had to behave as what was called a God-fearer in antiquity, a righteous Gentile. Yeah. So Christianity, therefore, developed as a movement in which Gentiles could at first have a role, and then eventually they could be dominant. Mm. But this was not going to be an easy negotiation in social terms. And then remember what we were just saying about who can be compelled to offer worship to the emperor. What are the Romans supposed to make of groups of people who are not practitioners of Judaism, who say that they are disciples of Jesus, but they refuse to offer sacrifice to the image of the emperor?
Not good.
This is what caused the persecution of Christianity within the Roman Empire during this period.
There's so many questions I have for you, but one is sort of from a personal perspective. I work as a professional storyteller and an oral historian, and I'm aware that much of the scriptures as we know them were passed down orally, and at some point were committed to print. And I'm always left with this confusion about the editor's choice. And how can we really know how, you know, it seems to me so much of what's put down at various times is reflective of a political choice or preference or a particular leaning. There's so much that I can't trust was truth, that it was malleable according to the few who wrote down the law. And I wonder how can you discern between the spirit of the original law as delivered orally versus what ended up in print?
Mm-hmm. It seems to me possible to trace within the New Testament itself very clear clues as to who the conduit of information was at a given time. And that's one reason for which I have had an interest in the biographies of people during this period. Figures such as Mary Magdalene mm-hmm. are interesting, not only intrinsically, because she's a fascinating person, but because she was also a center of teaching within the period of the New Testament. She is the source of many of the stories about Jesus' exorcisms. She is known as being a person who practiced anointing, a basic and very widespread ritual within the church. She is also within all of the Gospels a key figure in the understanding of the vision which leads to the idea that Jesus has been raised from the dead. These are powerfully formative influences on the New Testament. So we can take a figure such as Mary Magdalene, and we can understand her contribution to what ultimately became the New Testament. But also we need to set that side by side with other figures, such as Peter, the 12 apostles, James, whom I mentioned, Paul, and Barnabas. And all of these figures, as you rightly say, have their particular agendas in the way that all conduits of information
do.
And the way in which an editor puts them together is really very interesting. But it's become my growing conviction that actually the editors are only influential after the fact, and that the real influences are these initial conduits. So in my current project, I am looking particularly at them, and I'm asking the question, what did they know precisely about Jesus' Aramaic teaching? What can we see linguistically that shows them to be in touch with the way in which he instructed his followers in his own native language?
His native language was Aramaic?
Was Aramaic, exactly. That's right. Wow. A language about which we now know much more than we used to because of discoveries in the Judean desert. People often refer to the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're obviously very important, but the Dead Sea Scrolls are only one cache of texts.
Right.
And the result of that is that we now know much more about first century Aramaic than we have at any time in history since the first century. Using these materials and comparing them to the way in which the New Testament is written, we can discover the Aramaic environment of his teaching in a way that has not been possible before.
That's amazing. I mean, you had a great quote that said, what history demands is that we account for all evidence. And I love the fact that you're constantly looking at the larger context. You're always broadening and looking at the whole view, which is something that I obviously wish we did more today when in our own, you know, my particular religious community, or when, you know, Christianity is quoted in a political context, I always feel it's devoid of a larger context and history. And I guess in concluding, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on this. I'm disturbed by fundamentalism in whatever religion, but in particular, I think about Christianity and Judaism for that matter, because I think that fundamentalism implies that Jesus was literal and not a poet, and didn't speak in the language of metaphor and poetry. And I think you kind of deny him that when you take things for the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just would love to have your take on that in relation to what's happening today.
Yeah, I think that fundamentalism in its origin is a specific ideological movement. It was designed at the end of the 19th century in the United States.
Really?
Yes, exactly right. We didn't have it before. It was invented by a scholar whose name was Benjamin Warfield. He was active at Princeton University, and for this reason, fundamentalism used to be known as the Princeton theology. I like to remind my colleagues at Princeton of this fact from time to time. And the reason for it was that it was designed as a way to counter the teaching of Charles Darwin. The idea was that Darwin was falsely invoking rules of nature. And what we really had to do was to discover the infallible laws of the Bible. And therefore, it enumerated what these principles were. And it made the statement, unless you interpret the Bible to prove these principles, you're not really a Christian. Well, I think anyone can see that's not an historical interest in the Bible. It's not even a literal interest in the Bible. I mean, for example, it says you have to say the Bible is infallible. But it's rather interesting. Where does the Bible itself say that it's infallible?
Right.
You will simply not discover that passage. I have searched very diligently for a long time, and I can understand where the movement comes from. But at the end of the day, it's not a biblical movement. Instead, it's a reaction to modernism.
Wow.
And that's the way fundamentalism has unfolded since that time. It has, without doubt, influenced Judaism. It's influenced Islam. I mean, my heavens, it even influences economists, right? You have people who are evangelists of market fundamentals. That is, it opens the prospect of reducing reality to an ideological model. It really is not a religion. Instead, it's an ideology, sometimes about a religion. And therefore, I think if one is genuinely committed to a religious tradition, one actually has to resist the fundamentalist tendency, because fundamentalism is a form of idolatry. It's a form of approach, in this case, the Bible, that says, I know what the Bible is before I've read it. And unless you find those things in the Bible, you are not reading it properly. That's an attitude of fundamental mistrust in relation to the text itself. So I see this as part of a generational quest to outgrow this movement, which came about in the late 19th century and which has had a virulent effect cross-culturally. And the way that can be counteracted, as you suggest, is simply to be much more keenly aware of the context of all the events that we're dealing with. The events within the biblical material, yes, but also the context in which we operate. Because when we make assertions without taking account of the effect that they have on those around us, they still have that impact. And therefore, it's part of our responsibility to be aware of it.
I mean, I feel like you're also speaking about the trouble our country is in general. I feel like, you know, your words are really speaking to that to a large extent. Do you ever take solace in some of the lessons of the Bible in terms of leading us to a calmer place in our country?
I do. I mean, in particular, as you know, I recently wrote a book on the resurrection, in which it became very clear to me by looking carefully at the sources that the very thing which fundamentalists say is plain from the Bible is simply not there. That is, one of the fundamentals of fundamentalism that they tout is what they call Jesus' resurrection in the same body in which he died. They say it has to be physical, otherwise it doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. Well, as it happens, St. Paul, who was the earliest writer on the resurrection, specifically denies that resurrection is physical and insists that what is resurrected is what he calls a spiritual body. Mm-hmm. And so I go on to explain what he means by that. He means something tangible, but at the same time, not physical. When you make that kind of assertion, what you attempt to do is basically shut down anyone who doesn't agree with your own particular view. And the only way to free the text is to break that dogma. And what's interesting to me is that, as you suggest, our tendency, we refer to it as lack of civility. It is uncivil, no question. We talk about people being divided. They are. They take sides. True. But what's the engine of all that? I think the engine of all that is the insistence that only the particular ideological package that I subscribe to is the correct one. And it's got to the point now, of course, where one doesn't even need facts in order to support the package. In fact, you assert that the facts must be wrong if the result is not in accord with my own ideological preferences. Yeah, I think this is a fundamentalist mindset. Yeah. That has gradually affected, it has moved from its origin in religion to affect some forms of scholarship. For example, I have often run into resistance from scholars, not because they find fault with my evidence or the way in which I'm discussing it, but because it doesn't coincide with their results, you know, and therefore they want to oppose that, and they attempt to find some reason or another to do it, sometimes to their own confusion. So it's affected scholarship as religion, and now, yes, it's affected politics, it's affected the discussion of economics, which of course makes us as a society much less resilient and less flexible in dealing with severe questions as they arise. If you always insist that any given problem coincide with the solution of your ideology, you're just not very likely to be able to solve that problem.
Do you think that, I always love to quote the last line of my favorite Jewish folk tale, "This too shall pass." Is that possible?
I think it will. I have to tell you that over the past 40 years, there has been a very clear movement, especially among evangelical thinkers, to continue to emphasize the importance of the gospel, which is the whole point of the Evangelium, but to distance themselves from fundamentalism.
Wow.
And this, of course, is sometimes a struggle for them, and when they do it, is sometimes at great cost.
Yeah.
But this is actually occurring. I mean, I'll give you an example of this. At the time that I wrote Rabbi Jesus, to which you referred, one of the ideas of the book is that we should actually take the gospel according to Matthew seriously when it talks about Jesus' birth. And when it does so, Matthew's gospel specifies that Mary was discovered to be pregnant after Joseph and Mary had exchanged a marital contract, but before they were residing together.
Mm-hmm.
That, by the definition of the Mishnah, the principal Judaic work of that time, makes Jesus what's called a mamzer, someone who cannot demonstrate his own paternity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is clearly an important background to the whole development of the understanding of who Jesus was. Mm-hmm. And it also explains why it is that in the New Testament, there are different views of Jesus' paternity. The most famous one is that God was really the father, but that's only one of them. Another view is that Joseph was the father, the reasonable one, it seems to me. And yet another, that there was an illicit relationship that Mary had. This also appears. Well, of course, this caused something of a firestorm in some circles when I said that. But I was very touched that there were evangelical scholars who went into their journals in print to say, well, one moment, this is the evidence he cited. This is the Jewish context he's talking about. We're not saying that it happened as he said, but this is information that we have to take account of.
Yeah.
And in the intervening 20 years, you can see the idea making its way and making its impact felt.
That's great. I obviously could go on for another 2 hours, but unfortunately we have to end, but I have so much to think about, and I can't wait to hear your next lecture series. And when will that be?
Well, this would be in the autumn. I am still dithering about which day of the week is best. You know, with the new relationship to social gathering as a result of the pandemic, I just don't want to continue the old schedule. Yeah. I think I probably have to rethink it. So I'll be doing that during the course of the summer.
And what are you writing about this summer?
And this will be the Aramaic Jesus.
Okay.
So this will be teasing out how his Aramaic teaching got to the New Testament.
Wow. And to think all I'm going to be doing is sitting and filing my nails and reading bad literature. But, you know, every girl needs a break now and again.
There you go.
Thank you so, so much. I'm riveted, as always, by your ideas, and I'm looking forward to reading more and hearing more.
Many thanks. It's been a delight to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chilton. All the best. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.